It's Sal Capaccio.
Sal
Capaccio.
Sal
Capaccio.
Sal
Capaccio.
Sal
Capaccio.
Sal
Capaccio.
Sal
Capaccio.
Sal
Capaccio.
On WGR.
Sal Capaccio on the AT&T Hotline in just a moment. Real quick, though, an update on the WGR Golf Tournament, which will be July 9th. Marty Baron and Andrew Peters have been added. You can bid on them. Sal is one of those that's already been sold off. There's a buy now price. If you bid on one of us, it's a threesome with us. So, wait, that sounded weird. You get three golfers and Sal, or three golfers and Bulldog, as they've already been sold. You can also just buy foursomes for you and three friends, where you don't have anybody specifically with you. But Andrew Peters and Marty Baron just added to the golf tournament. I had a texter ask, is it best ball? It is not. It is a scramble. And scrambles are fun. Sal, good morning.
Morning, how are you?
How do you like scrambles? Have you ever played in a shamble, by the way?
But what's the scramble is a the scramble and a best ball is the same thing, isn't it? No?
No, no. Best ball is everybody plays their own and you take the best score.
No, best ball is everybody shoots and you take the best ball where it lies and everybody shoots from there.
No, that's a scramble.
Hmm. I think that most people that okay, I've only known that to be best ball, and every time I've played a best ball tournament, that's what happens. So I think people call it best ball when it's like that, even though it might be incorrect.
I think that's correct. I think people sometimes refer to it as best ball.
Yes.
But best ball actually is, like a two-person best ball, you play your own balls and take the lower score. So a four-person best balls, you play all your own balls and take the lowest
sense.
Score.
That makes sense. Yeah. But I think the WGR tournament is then a scramble.
Which is
often incorrectly referred to as a best ball.
That's right. We can educate everyone here. Do you know what
You're right about that. It does make more sense now. But and that's usually the way that you play things. But I'm excited. You know, I mean, I got sold in a matter of 3 hours and 12 minutes. So I think that's the record. I don't know. So I want to brag a little bit about that. But shortly after that, I believe you and Bulldog have both been sold.
Yes. Do you know what a shamble is? And have you ever played one?
No, I know what a shamtrosity is. No, I'm just kidding. What is a shamble?
A shamble is everybody hits their own drive, you pick the best drive, and then everyone plays their own ball in from there. So you do get your own score, but you are always using the best drive on the hole. It's not often, I don't know that I've been in very many shambles, maybe one or two. It's not a consistently used format, but And one of the things you'll learn about it is if you're like me, if you think, man, if only I could hit the ball straight off the tee, I'd be much better. Turns out you're not. Your score does not drop as much as you think it necessarily would.
Oh, I totally get that. As I've gotten older, my golf game has progressed to the point where I totally have learned that, you know, it's way easier to play the smart play and better, I should say, for your score to just play the smart play. And oftentimes that's because your drive is just bad, even though you're not like OB or something like that. And instead of trying to, you know, hit it through trees, you just punch it out and you get a bogey and you're like, hey, I'm good.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're talking about. I've also played in a format where, and you probably have too, where you must take a certain number of hits from each player.
Yeah.
You can't, because if you're with some sort of ringer or somebody who's scratch and you're not that good, you just take that person's ball every time in a scramble, but you can't do that in the format where you have to take everybody's hit a certain number of times.
Right, they'll do it where you have to take a certain number of tee shots. Like each person, you have to use two tee shots. My stance on that is that tournaments shouldn't do it because people don't keep track and don't care. Generally,
if I'm in those,
you know, you get six holes in and you're like, what? Who's it with you? Screw it. And nobody really keeps track of that, so I'm usually against that. All right, on to business, Sal. Yesterday at minicamp, sounds like it was a very interesting day, especially from the quarterback position, because as Howard has been asking for, not only did we see Josh Allen with the ones, but you referenced that Nathan Peterman looked really good. So where do you want to begin? Which one of those two is the bigger story to you?
Well, I think Josh Allen playing with the ones is the bigger story because we've yet to see it. And I think that's what everybody's been clamoring for and waiting for. So I think, you know, that's number one. How each guy looks, I think, is kind of secondary to kind of where they're lining up on the rep chart. And of course, coaches will continue to remind you that it is just a rep chart. It is not a depth chart. But it is noteworthy that Josh Allen took snaps with the first team. He was, you know, I wrote 11 on 11. Then I read a couple of people say it was 9 on 9, other media members, and I guess I didn't pay attention enough to notice if it was only 9 on 9, but either way, it was against the starting defense. And, He got six plays. The first four, they were all passes. The first four were shorter. And then he threw what I would say was his signature throw of the day, Jeremy, which is you had Kelvin Benjamin on a, you know, I don't know if I'd call it a fade route. He was kind of running downfield like a fade route, about 15 yards downfield. It turned out to be like a back shoulder throw. And I don't know if it was meant to be that way, but certainly was meant to be in the only spot that he could catch it because he's 6'5". He climbed the ladder, turned his body, came down with it. Perfect throw.
Man coverage?
That's exactly what you want to see.
Was it man coverage?
It looked like it was, and he was okay. Tight, too. It was tight coverage. And you know, he went up. He turned his body to the inside, walled off the defender, climbed the ladder, grabbed it, and came down. And there was a lot of ooze going on right there. Like, that was a nice throw. I think clearly Allen, to me, put it in that spot on purpose, and he knew that's what he wanted to do. Now, in the very next play, he tries to throw only maybe a 7 to 10-yard curl to Charles Clay, tight coverage in a window, couldn't get it there. In fact, Micah Hyde comes – jumps it, gets his hand in there, ricochets off a helmet, pops up in the air, and Tremaine Edmonds intercepts it, and that was how his session ended. But, okay. You know, I think that's a rookie mistake. But he did not look out of place. He looked competent. And, look, his arm is cartoonish. It just is. And I had this analogy yesterday that I said to Josh Reed. We were standing there watching. I said, Josh has a younger son like I do. And I said, Josh, you know when you're playing baseball or catch with your young son and you kind of just toss him the ball overhand. Sometimes you toss him the ball real soft with your wrist. You don't use your arm because you don't want to hurt the kid. He says, yeah. I go, that's when I watch Josh Allen, it seems like that's what he does. The difference is it goes 40 yards.
Yeah. Well, Sal, you're mentioning a couple things. The number one thing I've wanted out of the Bills passing offense is a quarterback that you don't have to avoid any throws. And, you know, Tyrod Taylor had his strengths, but I know that there are things that the Bills really didn't do or that Tyrod didn't do. And, you know, the world doesn't live and die with a back shoulder throw, but that's something that is a lethal weapon in the passing game for a lot of really good passing offenses, and the Bills haven't really employed it. So, to me, granted, it's mini camp. What am I getting out of it? Whatever, I'm getting that if you've only got six throws and you're going to be evaluated for throwing picks, but you're willing to throw to a tightly covered receiver on a back shoulder throw, like that's to me, that's a step forward. That's something this offense has needed.
Totally right about that, especially when you know your personnel, right? You have a 6'5 guy in Kelvin Benjamin that you're throwing that to. You know, when he was drafted, one of the things that, you know, was brought up that I said on the air was, you know, if the Bills know that he's not going to be, let's say, super, you know, he's not going to be pinpoint accurate like Tom Brady, then they're going to just, you know, then they can load up more on some of the bigger receivers, guys with bigger wingspans, guys that you can maybe miss a little bit more, but they can still come down with it. And, you know, that's the kind of guy, Kelvin Benjamin, that you can do something like that with. You don't have to put it in the perfect spot, but if you have a guy like that, you could put it in a spot where only he can get it. And there's a difference there. You know, you're not throwing there to Julian Edelman, you know, in that situation. So I think those guys, he has to know his personnel is what I'm saying. I think he did in that particular regard. We also don't know if he's being told, Jeremy, I don't know, for example, if he was being told, I don't think this is the case, but when we watch practice, he could be being told, I want you to throw to Charles Clay here on the curl. I know he might be covered. I want you to throw it to him. Maybe they want to see that throw. They want to see how he can kind of go and dictate that coverage and try to put it in that window. I don't think that's the case, but we always have to remember those things. What I think people would like, though, to hear, though, is that after that interception that he threw, where Tremaine Edmonds got up and got it, Josh Allen went right to the sideline, talked to Nathan Peterman. Then after that, he talked to Micah Hyde, and he said, How did you jump that so quickly? Micah Hyde basically said something to him about reading his eyes. And, you know, that's good that he went to Micah Hyde and asked him that. And hopefully it's something that he can take with him and improve on, you know, that he doesn't telegraph that next time.
Sal Capaccio on the AT&T hotline on Bill's minicamp. All right, so how about Peterman? It was a good day for him. Was it the best day you've seen from Bill's quarterback this entire offseason? Is it the best day you've seen, not in your life, but, I mean, just how good was Peterman and how many reps did he have?
Well, he was the number one quarterback, you know, with the ones for the most time. Other than with Josh Allen getting his reps, it was pretty much all the Nathan Peterman show. And again, this goes back to the rotation that they've had throughout this, because it's really been Peterman, McCarron on a daily basis. We'll see today if it goes back to AJ McCarron. What I tweeted yesterday was he was dropping dimes out here. And people have had fun with that, but you get that. And I think most people understand the reference. And if you're talking about a quarterback, that means that he's really putting the ball in some really good spots. I mean, look at Nathan Peterman. I don't know if I'd say it was, you know, the best day I've seen overall as a quarterback. Maybe it was, but I will say he made three of the best throws I've seen throughout these OTAs and minicamps so far. I mean, he dropped them into buckets over top of defenders right into receivers' hands when there was not much room to do it. And ironically, I'll say, though, twice the receiver didn't come down with it. Once, Patrick DeMarco just flat out dropped it when I think he tried to turn to run. And the other one, the receiver didn't, I don't know who it was, he didn't really bring it in quick enough. So the defender who was close by just reached his hand and then, you know, poked the ball away a little bit. But Nathan looked good yesterday. And, you know, we've said from the beginning, you guys know this, I've been kind of telling everybody, don't sleep on him as the starting quarterback this year. And I know that people make jokes about it. And they've said there's no chance or anything. I don't know. I don't think he's going to be the starter week one. As I sit here and talk to you, I don't think I would put him number one in the Hoosdak, but I will tell you, he is a legitimate option. If he keeps playing, if he does more of what he did yesterday, we're going to be talking about Nathan Peterman possibly starting week one at Baltimore.
Would you put him? You wouldn't put him as the favorite, though.
I wouldn't. I would still put AJ McCarron. I will not change on that until they go to camp and I see something. I need to see pads, real live action, what's going on there. I just think for me right now, I can't take what I see in these OTAs and mini camps and think that that changes anything about the plan at quarterback. The only thing that's really going to change as far as regular season plan is how they perform at training camp. But I'll have it in the back of my mind. I'll be quicker to do it though, Jeremy. That's what I'll say. I'll be quicker to put Nathan Peterman ahead if I see these things, because now I'm going to put it all together, but I'm just not going to do that right now before we get to training camp.
How about the front seven of this team, Sal? I'm asking you this to set up a question about training camp, but does the front seven of this team look like the strength of this team?
No, the strength is the secondary.
Okay.
Yeah, the strength is secondary, but I think this defense can be really, really good, and that front seven, if they stay healthy, can really be I'm gonna say like one of the best in the league. I think they have some issues at linebacker still, but I think they'll be consistent. I think they'll be able to do more than they did last year. They'll be able to stop the run a lot better. They really concentrated on fixing the middle of their defense. That's why they signed Star Lotulelei. That's why they drafted Harrison Phillips. That's why they drafted Tremaine Edmonds. You think those are three really tremendous additions right there to go along with who they already have there. But they are a little thin at linebacker, and it kind of showed itself yesterday, Jeremy. I mean, Matt Milano has been out with, he's got a bit of a hamstring. So Ramon Humber is your starting weak side linebacker. And, you know, last year I thought Ramon Humber started off the year well, but kind of struggled as it went on. And then that's why Matt Milano took over for him. Lorenzo Alexander was double shifting yesterday. He was playing with the ones and the twos as your strong side backer. You know, behind those guys, you got Xavier Woodson-Luster and, you know, who, right? And then you have Deion Lacey, you have Tanner Vallejo. These are not names that inspire a lot of confidence at this point to say, if you have to go into a game with these guys as your starters, that you're going to feel good about it. So, I mean, they have to stay healthy there, because if you talk about Milano and Edmonds and Alexander, I think, you know, that's a pretty good linebacking core. Now, granted, you know, Lorenzo's not going to be the guy that's going to be running around covering people all the time, but you have good athleticism next to him. But beyond that, they have some concerns there. So I think that is the concern with the defense. Although overall, if they're healthy, I think the front seven can be good.
And I think when you talk about, the reason I asked about the front seven is, will we get to a point in training camp at any, it's tough to predict this, but I guess what I'm wondering, Sal, is will the defense, it always ends up ahead of the offense, right? That's the cliche we hear every year. Oh, defense ahead of the offense. What I'm wondering is, can the offense hold its own against this defense? If we think the defense is going to be pretty good and the offense is going to go through some struggles, you know, at training camp, you're going to want to make sure, you know how it works when you coach. Sometimes you play dummy defense because the offense does need to work. So how will the Bills balance that if their defense looks like it is a legitimate strong unit, the strength of the team, and you're trying to get Allen and Peterman and McCarron their appropriate reps? You think we'll ever see a spot where, not the defense has to kind of lay off? And I guess, does that ever really happen?
Well, it did a couple of years ago. Remember, Rex Ryan had to do that, right? Because he said that the defense, I mean, remember he said he took Jerry Hughes out because he was, you know, wrecking the offense. And I think there were a couple times where they felt the defense was so far ahead that, you know, they kind of either laid off or let them go against the second team or third team or something like that, if I remember. But sure, I mean, but you have to be careful doing that. You know, you want to get your guys. You need, It's not about us laying off on one side. It's about you stepping up and doing what you're supposed to be doing on the other side. But you go in with plans. Everything is so finely detailed. I'm quite sure that Sean McDermott would tell Leslie Frazier, you know, hey, for this particular series today, when we go 11 on 11, this is what I want you to do and how I want you to structure your defense. And while the offense does this, because I want to see how they react to this sort of defense. So I think you can kind of, you know, you can kind of stage it and you can kind of set it up. It doesn't mean those guys are backing off. It just means at least you're putting your offense in positions where you can see certain things the defense either is doing or is not doing. And like I said, if you ever really want to, you could have the offense go against, you know, the second unit if you think that, you know, they need that to kind of show, even for their own confidence, if that's the case. Look, the offense is, we've heard everybody. You had Deion Dawkins on this morning. I'm guessing he told you that, you know, there's a lot in this offense. You know, he told us that a couple weeks ago.
He said it's different. He almost seemed not quite speechless, but just like, I don't know how to say it, but it's just a lot different.
Yeah, and LeSean McCoy said the same thing yesterday. He said it's a lot. There's a lot of studying. He said there's a lot that goes into it. It's all about getting the right matchups, and that's a theme we're hearing over and over again. LeSean actually said something interesting yesterday when he was asked about the offense and what it looks like. He said, we'll look similar to the Patriots. He said, because that's where Daboll comes from. He's all about finding mismatches. He said, and he goes, I know they have Gronk. He goes, but if you watch them play, they're always trying to find the mismatch. And that's what we're trying to do. And he used an example of getting Charles Clay on a specific linebacker, if that's the case, or Kelvin Benjamin on a specific player. And that's what you're trying to do. So from that regard, that's kind of the philosophy of the offense. But every person we talk to says it's a detailed, in-depth offense. It has a lot of moving parts. It has a lot of, I'm not going to use the word complication because no one has said that yet. No one has said it's complicated. They've all just said it's very detailed and in-depth, and there's a lot there, and there's a lot of studying that goes involved into it.
Maybe, Sal, you know, the linemen, I'm thinking about them here. I'm thinking about Deion Dawkins saying it's just different. Do linemen have a lot more to think about now than before? Because it's not the power versus the zone blocking. It's whatever that week requires. So it's almost like you might have to teach the offensive lineman and install every possibility, and each week it'll be a different group of plays that you'll be using.
Totally right. So this is how offensive systems normally work is, as long as you stay true to a system, you have certain rules in that system. So no matter kind of what play you're running, you're always going to have certain rules that you follow, whether it's outside zone system, inside zone, whether it's, I don't know, if it's wing T or midline option or something like that, you're always going to have certain rules you follow. Now, you can deviate from those rules on certain things the defense does, but you always kind of try to stay true. As an offensive coordinator, you teach your players, this is your rule. When in doubt, stick to your rule. Well, if you go from one system to the other, and you're going from outside zone system to power and gap scheme and all this kind of stuff, well, you can't stick to your rules all the time because your rules are going to change on a weekly basis, as you point out. So yeah, I mean, that's why it gets a little different. You can't fall back on, oh, well, you know what? I kind of unsure who I block here. I'll just stick to my rule because that's not the same play as before. That's not what we did last week. So your rule would be totally different because these systems are completely different when you go through them and think about how each of them operate.
Sal Capaccio on the AT&T hotline. All right, Sal, anything specific you're going to watch for today?
Yesterday, I concentrated a lot on the offense and seeing who was, you know, rotating in with the first, you know, offensive line, the second offensive line, things like that. Today, I want to look a little bit more at the skill players. I did know that Robert Foster, and I noticed this and I tweeted it, UDFA, an undrafted free agent wide receiver, was getting reps with the first team. I talked to him after, and even he says, like, you know, it's everybody's just getting reps, you know. So I wouldn't read too much into it, but I do think it's noteworthy that, you know, Robert Foster was in on the first two plays. They gave him an end around. So I'm going to try and look at more of the skill position. I'm kind of one of the areas I haven't looked at enough, I don't think, is the running back rotation, you know, where that's going. Chris Ivory seems to be the number two guy. Travaris Cadet comes in. They do have Marcus Murphy. They have some guys back there. So, you know, how is that game? What is that rotation? So those are things that I'll be looking for today. I think a little bit more of the skill position players and how, you know, they're rotating in and out, because I've been looking at the line, and that pretty much hasn't changed, by the way. It's been the same offensive line, Ryan Groy back at center, Dukas and Miller at guard, Dawkins and Mills at tackle, and then the same second and third unit as last week as well, which I pointed out.
All right. Well, we'll be glued to the station for this afternoon when you appear with the guys this afternoon, and look for your work at WGR550.com.
All right, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Sal. Sal Capaccio on the AT&T hotline. So the World Cup has been announced as coming back to the U.S. along with Mexico and Canada in 2026. That one of the news stories today. Toronto likely to get games. There's the bid that included Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. BMO Field's going to add maybe 15,000 seats sometime in the next 8 years to accommodate a game up there. So great. Good. Bring the World Cup back. It's 2026, so 8 years from now, who knows? Hopefully we've mended fences with Canada if we're going to be co-hosting. And Mexico, for that matter. 803-0550-1-8. Maybe fences aren't exactly a good thing to talk about there. 1-888-550-2550. Scott Pianowski, when we return, some fantasy football stuff for you. I've got a Dynasty draft coming up on Saturday. Dynasty leagues. Keeper leagues, all that stuff, IDP leagues. We'll talk to Scott Pianowski, who we had on during the season last year. We're bringing him back again this year. We had a good time with him on Thursdays. Your lineup questions. So Scott Pianowski joins us next here on WGR.
I think that the kid is special. I mean, he's a hard worker. He's very smart. He's definitely very intelligent, with his conversations. And he's just different. I mean, like, he's a giant kid. He's fast. He has a strong arm, and he's very athletic. So I like the kid.
Deion Dawkins, you've got Bills players raving about Josh Allen, the belief that he is special. Sean McCoy said it yesterday, Deion Dawkins saying it with us this morning. Good morning, Jeremy White with you. Brayton Wilson is producing. We're going to talk to Scott Pianowski, some fantasy football stuff coming up in just a bit. As the League of Shopes and Dreams, I know you don't care about our league, but whatever, maybe you can, get some information of your own. Sports, Yahoo Sports. Scott Pianowski, who we had on all last year for some Dynasty fantasy football chatter, who you might want to pick up, the rookies from this year, strategies that you can implement. The World Cup in 2026 is coming to the U.S. along with Canada and Mexico. The closest site likely to be Toronto. Also MetLife Stadium, maybe Philly, maybe Washington, maybe Cincinnati. But all three countries will have part of it. The automatic bid process, that's not yet been determined. It does not mean all three teams get an automatic bid. The field will also expand to 48 by then. So it does not mean an automatic berth, at least not yet. 60 of the 80 games for the 2026 World Cup will be in the U.S. So that's cool, too. That's the big news of the day. Bill's minicamp continues. Sal Capaccio, if you missed him, we just spoke. You can find it on demand at WGR550.com. They have another practice today and tomorrow, and then they wrap until training camp. You can also bid on the WGR Golf Tournament online at WGR550.com. We've just added Marty Baron and Andrew Peters. Scott Pianowski on the AT&T Hotline. Scott of Yahoo Sports and Fantasy Guru, who we talked to a lot last year. Scott, good to hear you again.
Yeah, it's good to talk some football. How you doing?
Doing all right, doing all right. I've got lots of questions, in part because, you know, we're getting to some fantasy season, I guess. It's still a little bit of the off season until we get into the depth of training camp. But I'm, for the first time ever, going to be in a dynasty league. And I've done plenty of fantasy football. And for anyone that might be, I think this is the time of year where people can think about changing their league if they want to. Maybe you're in a league that is a yearly league, and you meet with your friends and say, maybe we should switch to Dynasty. So let's talk about Dynasty Leagues. How much different is the mindset for a Dynasty League that's starting out? This isn't a rookie draft. This isn't a free agent draft. It's brand new. We got a brand new league. Should I just draft pretty much like normal, or should I be thinking differently with Dynasty?
I don't think it's a major difference. I think the differences get overplayed sometimes. When my objective is always to win in the current year, or to be competitive in the current year. I mean, obviously, if you get really close between two players and one player is 24 and one player is 28, I could see how that would frame your thinking if the players were literally tied in every other way. But my goal in any kind of keeper or dynasty is to be good now. And also, if you're starting up a dynasty league, this is kind of goes for any fantasy football league or any fantasy league in general, but especially for dynasty league, make sure you pick your owners carefully, because it seems like in dynasty, the weaker owners or the less engaged owners have maybe a little bit too much power in what goes on, and the quality of ownership and the continuity of ownership from year to year is much more important in a dynasty league rather than seasonal, where, you know, if somebody decides not to come back the next year, it doesn't have any repercussion really. But it's a much different thing in dynasties. Just make sure you're getting the right group of guys who all have a connection, or girls who have a connection to each other, to, for the best possible experience.
How do you approach? Is there any sort of, I don't know, tried and true method in your eyes? Should I be looking at a coach? Should I be looking at a quarterback? You know, are Bears players more interesting now because they have young quarterback and young, it would seem, progressive coach? And while this might not be the year that they break out, if you believe in the Bears, you would elevate them a little bit. Whereas, I mean, the Bills or anybody like that, is it smart to follow quarterbacks around? Is it smart to follow coaches? Should I just believe in Sean McVay because of what he's shown? Mm-hmm. And a receiver on the Rams would have better value because that system works better, or Todd Gurley or something like that?
Yeah, you have to believe in the quarterback. You have to believe in the system. And if you were able to get on board with McVay early last year, now maybe to some people it was just a matter that Jeff Fisher wasn't there, that staff had been overhauled. And if you were able to figure out, okay, wait a minute, they improved their offensive line. They added a progressive offensive coach who had done well with Washington. It's really hard sometimes to know when there's a successful offense. For example, the new Bears coach is from Andy Reid's team and offense, and we're not in the building. We don't know exactly how much of their offense is Andy Reid, how much of it was Nagy, the new Bears coach. But still, if you got to the Rams early, you could have maybe gotten Todd Gurley as a second round pick or under market, and what a great pick that would have been. You may have picked up Goff off waivers thinking, okay, he only played 7 games as a rookie. That isn't really symbolic of anything. So you look at what teams, who could be the next Rams. It's a mistake to necessarily assume anybody's going to have a breakthrough like the Rams did. But what offenses are in better situations, maybe because the coaching or the personnel turned over? You mentioned the Bears, who were a great example of that. And I'm also really interested in Tennessee. Tennessee had the oldest coaching staff in the league, and it's been overhauled. Matt LaFleur is the new offensive coach. I think it's a time we want to see a different offensive voice talk to Marcus Mariota. Last year, they took a rookie receiver in Corey Davis, number five pick overall, hurt most of his rookie year, or much of it. Didn't score a touchdown until the playoffs. He had 2 in their playoff loss to New England, so at least he showed something at the end of the season. But here's a team that desperately needed a remodel, an update. It doesn't mean the new coaches are going to be better, but it just felt like maybe the older coaches, they're kind of on their last legs as NFL coaches, and we just need something new. Certainly it's what the Rams needed last year. So I think maybe the Bears or the Titans have a chance, if anybody comes even close to what the Rams did last year, and it's a mistake maybe to follow that to the full definition. But I think the Titans and the Bears are two of the most interesting teams that I want to watch closely this summer to get a sense of where their offenses are headed.
Do you think there's any danger in just, and I'm one to do it too, do you think there's any danger in this, or is it just the way the league is going, to just all of a sudden believe in younger coaches?
Oh, no, I believe in it. The way we've seen in the last, I don't know, 5, 10, 12 years, we've seen more of a morphing of college football and NFL. Where it used to be, if you watch college football and then you watch an NFL game, it was like 2 totally different things. They were hardly the same sport. And now we see all these different concepts that work in college or used in college being used in the NFL, even though the rules are a little bit different. A lot of people thought, well, Deshaun Watson, great with that run-pass option in college, but the rules are a little bit different in the NFL. Maybe he can't do it. And I know Watson didn't play that many games last year before he got hurt, so he's still kind of an unknown coming back from a major injury. I mean, nobody can be that good, right? But as the games morph closer together, and I think there's just been a boom of offensive design and offensive philosophy has changed significantly in the last few years. I think it's a young person's game. A football coach is a very hard job to have. I mean, these guys, it goes back. You think of, you know, Dick Vermeil sleeping in his office, and you know all the media demands. You guys are great, but you know maybe some of the other media is a little bit more pressing, but. It's a tough coach, tough job to have, and I think it's a young person's job. I mean, you know, Belichick is an exception, maybe Pete Carroll's an exception, but I would want, if I owned a football team, I would be hoping to find the next Sean McVay and think, okay, I might be good for the next 10 or 15 years with somebody at the peak of their career.
Scott Pianowski, Yahoo Sports Fantasy on the AT&T Hotline. All right, Scott, so the rookies that are coming in this year, for anyone doing a rookie draft, Saquon Barkley got all the nice things said about him with generational talent. Do you like Barkley the best of the running backs that are available as rookies?
I do, because I think there's a chance that Pat Shurmur might be a special coach. Interesting. You think about Bill Belichick, right? He had a really good reputation, went to Cleveland, didn't do well, and then he got, you know, knocked down a peg or two with his reputation before he rebuilt it. Shurmur was the Cleveland coach. Didn't really work out for him. He was in Minnesota last year and made an offense. I mean, nobody thought that Case Keenum was going to be anything other than NFL backup. He was a Pro Bowl quarterback last year, surrounded by really good pieces. Shurmur goes to the Giants now. And at Barkley, you know, we saw running backs really made a big bounce back in fantasy. A lot of people talked about receivers being dominating the first round. Go zero RB. Don't take running backs early. Well, last year, the running backs got their revenge, and a lot of that is because we're using them so much in the passing game. That was a big part of Gurley's resurgence. 2 years ago, David Johnson was challenging to be a 1,000-yard rusher and receiver. He's back this year. Le'Veon Bell, we know, is a multidimensional player. So even though there may be two-thirds or three-quarters of the league may have a platoon in the backfield, the teams that have, you guys have Shady McCoy in Buffalo, obviously, you can catch it and run it. It is a dynamic player. And so I feel like Barkley with Shurmur, I mean, we don't really like Eli Manning at this stage of his career, but if Beckham is healthy, Evan Engram looked like a terrific player last year. He's not really a traditional tight end. He's more of a jumbo wide receiver matchup problem. Even Shepard as a fourth option on that offense is dynamite. I don't know what Eli Manning has back, but I'm excited about Shurmur. I'm excited about Barkley in part because he's so dynamic as a pass catcher, and he can be. There aren't a ton of these backs, even though there's been an upswing towards them in the last few years, but the guys who can stay on the field in all three downs, the guys who can stay on the field if the team's ahead or behind, the guys who can catch the ball, the guys who are going to play in all packages, get the short touchdowns, extremely valuable. Barkley immediately slots, not just in the first round. You could conceivably take him in the middle of a first round of a fantasy draft.
And you're talking about all situations. One of the things I was looking at yesterday in my prep was, for fantasy purposes, is snap percentage. It would seem to me that that's as important as anything out there. What percentage of the time is he on the field?
Sure. Yeah, and you know, we're in a day and age now where we have a lot more access to data. Even something that is granular like snap percentage, just being on the field is important. And you know, being on the field in all situations, and that's, you're going to really need to know that. It used to be with running backs, and I still feel this way to a large extent. You want a running back from a winning team, because then you'll be running the ball late in the game. Then you'll get some of those downhill carries against defenses that have been worn down and beat up. But if a player is versatile enough to be used in different packages, then it maybe doesn't matter so much if he's on a 4-12 or 5-11 team, because he may be playing in the hurry up. He may be playing on third down. So that it's certainly how much you are on the field and your usage in those situations as well is something we have to pay attention to, understanding that maybe two-thirds of the league is just going to have a platoon anyway. I mean, look at the teams that are in the Super Bowl, the Patriots and the Eagles, you know, both using multi-player platoons in their backfield, and now New England went totally against type and drafted a first-round running back, something they rarely do. So we have some new situations to grok out there with New England. The Seahawks drafted a running back in the first round, so some new ground to cover with these teams. But, yeah, how much are you on the field and how much opportunity are you getting? Certainly major fantasy questions that we always have to ask and reevaluate.
How about age? Scott Pianowski on the AT&T Hotline. For receiver, for example, 29 years old, Antonio Brown. He might be the best receiver in the game. Is he the best receiver to take in a dynasty league that's just starting at 29 years old? The age curve for receivers isn't quite what it is for running backs, but one would think that Brown has a couple years left. The question is how many?
Yeah, as long as you're not worried about being the cliff season, and I am not with Brown. Although the interesting thing with him is I think the sneaky part of Pittsburgh, the thing that I'm worried about there is Roethlisberger. I don't know how much longer he wants to play. He's in his mid-30s. He's a quarterback who rarely plays a full season. They've done everything they can to legislate quarterback hits out of the game. It's usually a really safe bet that most of these guys play 16 games. And Roethlisberger, you know, whether it's he holds the ball too long or just takes on contact sometimes, I just wonder what stage of his career that he's at. I don't think it's as maybe dire as the Eli Manning situation may be. But as far as Brown goes, certainly the number one receiver on my 2018 board, and I still think multiple seasons ahead of the Antonio Brown we know and love, and right now clearly separate. I mean, I would not take Beckham over him. I would not take Julio Jones over him. I would not take Hopkins, who was fantastic with Watson last year. I would not take him over Brown. As long as there's a two in the first number, especially with a receiver, I will treat him like he's still a multiple-year player, a multiple-year contributor around his peak, and that would not push him down my dynasty board.
And finally, how about the idea of playing the long game? for a launching a league, saying maybe I get heavy veterans, Tom Brady and LeSean McCoy, guys that are not going to be keepers for a long time. I'm going to get them. I'm going to try to win. If I don't win, I don't have any problem trading them away for future draft picks. Or maybe that's my goal all along, is all older players that I can trade for draft picks and playing the long game. Is it worth it in Dynasty League to try and do something like that?
If I wouldn't go into a league with that as my objective, but if that's where the value was, I could see doing it. You hit on a key thing, though. If you are in a dynasty league and realize you can't win, then it becomes, load up the truck. Make sure everybody knows. Make sure you have leverage. Make sure you make it known that, Tom Brady's available. Just don't take the analogy is, don't be the basketball team that comes over half court and takes the first shot it sees. Try to work the ball and get open and get a decent shot. Try to work the room a little bit. Remember that winning a league is hard. You have the leverage. If you have the piece that maybe can push somebody over the top, make sure everybody knows it's available. I'm a value guy. If the room pushed me to that way, if the room, a lot of times in new startup dynasty leagues, you do see people are just so insistent on taking rookies and young players that they leave. McCoy would be a great example. A proven player, a guy who still has, I think, a lot left in the tank, but maybe because he's on a team that isn't one of the Super Bowl favorites, that may lower some of the profile. The quarterback situation is obviously up in the air right now. We don't know how good the overall offense will be. I think McCoy could be a guy, maybe not in Buffalo because people are clued into him, but I could see McCoy being a good value in a lot of leagues just because he's not the shiny new toy anymore, and he's not on a shiny offense necessarily. So a lot of times the quote-unquote boring but established veterans, whether it be seasonal or redraft or dynasty, or the guys who I end up getting because they end up being half round, around and a half discounted in value, depending on what pocket we're talking about in the draft. I think they can be excellent targets for fantasy players.
And for McCoy, you might get some added value in that, the quarterback situation being uncertain, he'll get a heavy load. And if you're in a PPR league where you're getting points per reception, or even if you're not, he was the number one receiver on the Bills last year, in addition to being the number one running back.
Right. You don't have a lot of running backs you can say that about who he's the featured part of the passing game as well. But I look at the receivers on this roster right now and I think, why wouldn't Shady be the guy who has the most targets or at least the most catches by the end of the season?
Scott Pianowski. All right, Scott, we'll talk to you again closer to fantasy drafts for more people, and we'll do it again during the regular season as well on Thursdays. Good to talk to you again. Thanks for joining.
I look forward to it. Thanks for having me. And Yahoo Sports is open for your fantasy football needs. So go over there, mock draft, get your league set up, and let's have a fun year.
All right. Scott Pianowski. You can follow him on Twitter. It's Scott_Piano, WSKI. Scott Pianowski, Yahoo Sports. I got a text here. Can you try and touch on the auction format for fantasy? I'm not super familiar with them, but considering joining one. Every single league in fantasy football should switch to auction. Every one of you, if you are not in one, I feel like I'm late on this. I've only been in auction leagues for 4 years and will never go back. I don't think you'll ever go back. If you haven't done it yet, call your commissioner today and say, listen, we're suckers. We got to get on this. You must play auction. A snake draft is you draw names out of a hat and then whoever picks first gets Antonio Brown. And your whole season, or whoever, why'd you lose? I didn't get to pick the first 8 players. I drafted 9th. I'm at the mercy of whatever. Mock drafts are silly. You get the same 10 players going in the first round, just maybe a slightly different order. Same 10 players. It's terrible. Strategy. Join an auction league. Switch to auction if you aren't. There is no going back. 803-0550. My thanks to Scott Pianowski. We'll get a Dahlin fix. Rasmus Dahlin at 9:15 because... we're going to talk to Joel Lundqvist, Henrik Lundqvist's brother. He was a linemate with Rasmus Dahlin. So we'll talk to Joel Lundqvist coming up at 9:15.
And we'll also have the latest edition of Guess the Country coming up.
Ooh, is that next?
Yes, that'll be next.
All right, I'm excited for it. Guess the Country on the way next on WGR. Charlie Steiner on the call. Recap it, Deadspin right here from Barry Pachesky, that the unwritten rules of baseball, that the Pirates and the Diamondbacks were playing a game. Diamondbacks were dead. Joe Musgrave dealing for Pittsburgh. 4 hits through 6. Pittsburgh had a 5-0 lead. The Pirates put a leadoff batter on. Braden Shipley hit Josh Harrison in the top of the 7th. the fifth hit by pitch in a game between two teams with the history of beanballs. So, you know, they're winning the game and they're rivals, so they hit the guy. And then the Diamondbacks scored 9 runs. So their effort to say, we're up 5-0 here, we're going to go ahead and bean a guy to send a message that we're not going to be pushed around. And then they lost the game as a rally ensued, and they scored 9 straight. Bisons. Speaking of the Bisons, this weekend they're wearing those jerseys, those Wings jerseys, and that's pretty great. So they're changing to the Buffalo Wings. Today is tomorrow, Topps Dog Day at the park. Dogs get in free. A Friday night bash on Friday with happy hour and fireworks. Labatter Day. You can win beer for a year. There's also a tent party. There's going to be a giant inflatable Labatt blue can, and if somebody hits it with a home run, somebody wins beer for a year. And then Sunday's Father's Day. So, the fireworks show, June 15th, that's this Friday, the Honda Friday Night Bash. You can get all your information, tickets, schedule, promotions at bisons.com. Also, a quick thing this weekend on Saturday. I know you're all excited for the League of Shopes and Dreams fantasy draft, the Dynasty League. It's also our sister station, Alt Buffalo's kerfuffle. And I've been to that a few times. Saturday is looking like it's going to be nice out. Let me just double check here, see what the weather's looking like for Saturday. There's still tickets available to kerfuffle. So if you're looking for something to do, head downtown on Saturday. Oh, yeah. All clear. 79 to 74. And, yeah. Upper 70s, upper 60s for Showtime down at Canal Side. So if you want to hit kerfuffle, go for it. 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550 to join us.
Time for the international game that is taking the world by storm.
Yes.
Yes.
Literally international game,
yes.
As we celebrate the World Cup by guessing countries. Guess the country. Do you misguess the prospect? I know people misguess the prospect very much. The draft prep. But guess the country is not bad for the World Cup.
No.
I do dig this. We are learning things. Mm-hmm. For instance, hold on. I'm supposed to retain things that I learned. I learned that Peru has the largest sand dune and also a very big canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that Denmark is an archipelago nation. I didn't realize it was so many islands in Denmark.
Yep.
All right. Now I'm ready to learn again.
All right. Well, here you go. Here's your first clue for this edition of Guess the Country. This country is the largest raspberry exporter, accounting for 1/3 of all raspberries in the world.
Raspberries. I'm doing the same thing I did during Guess the Prospect for football, though. You start talking, and I, like, take bullet points, but we're going with, you know, quicker clues here. Okay, raspberries. Let's go with... I should just stream of consciousness this and embarrass myself. Like, raspberries grow on bushes. They got to be in somewhat temperate climates. It's probably a northern hemisphere thing. I'm going to go with Belgium. Okay, go ahead. Next.
This country's clockmaking industry is older than the Swiss, having made clocks for 600 years earlier than the Swiss.
Good thing you put the Swiss in there, because everybody would have guessed Swiss for clocks. Raspberries and clocks come from, everybody knows this, Portugal. No, okay, nope.
At 77,474 square kilometers, this country is around 2/3 the size of the state of New York.
All right. Everybody knows that raspberries and clocks in a country 2/3 the size of New York is... is Morocco.
This country is largely mountainous and is landlocked, with only one of the world's famous rivers running through 10.3% of the country.
Everybody knows that... I'm just going to keep doing this. Everybody knows that raspberries and clocks and landlocked countries 2/3 the size of New York could only be... Scrolling through all the teams in the World Cup. All right, landlocked eliminates so many. It's Croatia. No, no, it's not. It's not. That's not Croatia. It's doesn't have coastline. It is Senegal. Okay.
The word vampire is the only word from this country that is accepted worldwide.
Everybody knows that raspberries and clocks and two-thirds the size of New York and landlocked and vampires come from Serbia. See, if I repeat all the clues, we'll remember it. And now you'll be watching the World Cup and Serbia will be playing. You're like, you can turn your friend. Do you know that they export the largest number of raspberries in the world? I like that one. All right.
Here are a few other clues from Serbia that might interest you. This country's capital city is one of the oldest cities in all of Europe, while it has also won the title of the City of the Future for Southern Europe, the contest sponsored by The Economist magazine, I guess. 18 Roman empires were born on this territory that is now known as Serbia. Of course, one of the world's top tennis players, and Novak Djokovic, is from this country, and they opened their World Cup tournament against Costa Rica on Sunday.
All right. Now you learned about Serbia. Russia and Saudi Arabia play tomorrow, 11 a.m., first game of the World Cup. When we get back, we'll get a little hockey in. We've got on the way Joel Lundqvist, teammate, linemate of Rasmus Dahlin with Frölunda in the Swiss League. In the Swedish League. So stay tuned for that. Joel Lundqvist next on WGR.